Welcome everyone to the Cotofana Anatomy podcast. This is season 2, and the title of season 2 is Introduction to the Face. In the last 3 episodes, we talked about facial aging, facial biomechanics, and the facial fat compartments. And in this 4th episode, we are looking at facial muscles. And facial muscles is a pretty important topic and point in a face. And this is why I'm having again Pete with me for this podcast. Pete, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks, Sebastian. Good to be back and recording again.
Yeah, that's true, actually. We did a couple of amazing podcasts in the past, and today we can focus on facial muscles. And first of all, I have to say that we will have on the Cotofana Anatomy webpage an entire course focusing only on facial muscles. Well, to be precise, how the function of facial muscles can be blocked with neuromodulators to treat the face for wrinkles and for age-related appearances from volume loss. So there will be a separate course about facial muscles. But today, just a little bit of a short introduction into facial muscles. So first of all, facial muscles, they all receive their nerve supply from cranial nerve number 7, the facial nerve. And facial muscles, all of them have one unique feature in common, which means they are needed to move the skin. So it means when a nerve connects to the respective muscle fiber, activates that respective muscle fiber, the muscle fiber contracts, and then the skin is being moved. And this is why the movement of the facial muscles, or even the names of those facial muscles, are totally different than to any other muscle in the human body. Normally, the muscles in a human body follow the nomenclature of flexors, extensors, pronators, supinators, but in a face, they're totally different. They either are called from the bony feature, from they emerge, like from the zygomatic arch, that's why we have zygomaticus major and minor, or depending on where they are located, for instance, a mentalis muscle or frontalis muscle, or depending on which facial expression they're doing, like corrugator or resorius or levator angli oris or depressor angli oris or depressor labii inferioris, depending on what they do, on which facial expression they do, this is how they are named after. And this is very different than how the normal facial muscle nomenclature is working in a human body. In addition to this, facial muscles are also very special because they do not have a covering fascia. Normal facial muscles, they interact with the surrounding connective tissue in a way that each twitch of a facial muscle fiber, each twitch, each single movement, each contraction is immediately translated into skin movement. And this is only possible if the muscle fiber is directly connected to the connective tissue envelope, and that is connected directly to the skin, because this is what the facial muscles do. They move the skin. So it means facial muscles have no covering fascia. Skeletal muscles, as opposed to this, they do have a covering fascia, because skeletal muscles, they have origin and insertion, and normally they approach origin and insertion, and their effect is only visible at origin at insertion. So only at these two points. And this is why skeletal muscles can be covered by a fascia to kind of protect and that movement and to allow for gliding of that movement. But as facial muscles, they are different. What they do is they don't have a covering fascia. At each specific point of the muscle fiber length, not only at origin and insertion, so it means at any point along its pathway, the facial muscle can interact with the three-dimensional connective tissue network, and that effect is then transmitted to the skin. For instance, you can see that on the frontalis muscle. The frontalis muscle spans the entire forehead, and you have wrinkles across the entire forehead, not only at the area of the eyebrow or not only at the area of the hairline, because there will be origin and insertion of the frontalis muscle. Oh, by the way, frontalis muscle, the true name of this muscle that's sitting in the forehead is actually anterior belly of the occipito frontalis muscle. It's a fairly long name, but the muscle that we see is actually just located in the forehead, and this is why we call it frontalis muscle, but actually the true name is significantly longer. And what's also funny enough about facial muscles is the muscle, there is a muscle located in the midface which carries the longest name for a muscle in the human body, and that muscle is called levator labii superioris alec venasi. Honestly, until I spell that name, I already fall asleep because it's such a long name, and no other muscle in the human body has such a long name. So there are a couple of interesting facts about facial muscles.
Those are important Trivial Pursuit information.
Yeah, that is true, but honestly, that's absolutely useless knowledge. I mean, unless you are an anatomist or unless you are a surgeon dealing with the face all the time or treating the face all the time, and are focusing on gummy smile and on bunny lines, otherwise you don't really need to know that muscle name, which is fairly long, actually. So when it comes to facial muscles, it's kind of interesting to understand that anatomists in the past, they didn't do a good job. They just did not do a good job. And the reason why they didn't do a good job was because they were focusing on each muscle individually. Like they do it on a body, where they're looking, for instance, at biceps muscle isolated or a triceps muscle isolated. But in a face, they tried to do that, and the result is incomplete knowledge. And this is why I was struggling today so much with understanding facial muscles. And the reason is facial muscles, they have to be seen as a unit with the surrounding connective tissue. The surrounding connective tissue in the face is referred to as the superficial fascia in the face, and the superficial fascia in the midface, it's called SMAS. In the temple, it's called superficial temporal fascia. In the forehead, it's called frontalis muscle. In the neck, it's called platysma. In the periorbital area, it's called orbicularis oculi. So it's a superficial fascia, but this fascia is not a two-dimensional plane, it's a three-dimensional compound of connective tissue. And this three-dimensional compound includes the facial muscle, surrounds the facial muscles, and allows to transmit the movement from each facial muscle to the overlying skin. So it's like the muscle that connects the movement or generates the movement, and then the connective tissue connects to the overlying skin. So this is kind of what this three-dimensional connective tissue network is there for. And I think it's really important to understand that when you combine the knowledge of the superficial fat compartments, we understand that the superficial fat compartments are embedded within this three-dimensional connective tissue network. In one of the previous episodes, we talked about the superficial and the deep fat compartments in a face, and the superficial fat compartments are a little bit more yellowish in color, as opposed to the deep fat compartments are a little bit more orangey. And this more yellowish, this brighter color, originates because there's more connective tissue, there's more collagenous fibers included in that area. And even if you perform ultrasound, there is a very specific and characteristic way how superficial fat displays in ultrasound imaging. So there's a very specific way, and this is only because the facial muscles are a biomechanical unit with the three-dimensional connective tissue network that's lying on top of them, and that connective tissue network, it's forming like a scaffold, almost like the walls of a honeycomb. But the walls of the honeycomb, they still need to have a content, and that content is the superficial fatty layer. So the superficial fat in a face is embedded in a three-dimensional network of connective tissue, and when the facial muscles are moving, they move that three-dimensional connective tissue network, and with this also the superficial fat is moving. And this is why previous study has shown that the superficial fat is statistically significantly moving more than a deep fat. So it all makes sense if you put all of these things together. But if you look only at a muscle individually, then of course you do not do the arrangement in a face justice. So what the facial muscles are doing after they leave the bone, by the way, almost all of them have a bony origin except risorius muscle and except frontalis muscle, to be precise, the anterior belly, because the posterior belly of the occipital frontalis muscle, it does have a bony origin. So these two muscles, frontalis and risorius, they do not have a connection to the bone. But what happens after that? Well, after that, they transition from the bone into more superficial planes. Then they are integrated into this mass, integrated into this three-dimensional collagenous network. And after that, they connect to the skin. So it means they have a very oblique pathway from the bone to the skin. And when they connect to the skin, then they form natural boundaries, like the nasolabial fold, like the labiomandibular fold. These are natural boundaries, and they are formed by facial muscles that from deep travel to superficial. And if we understand this, it makes absolutely sense that when the facial muscles contract, they move the skin because they are attaching to the skin, right? So this is a very important aspect that happens. And now we need to think about in which areas of the face is a tight connection needed between muscles and skin, because in the cheeks or in the midface, on lateral midface, there's no tight connection needed between the muscle and the skin. This is why this area is moving a lot. But in areas, for instance, where precise movement is needed, where accurate movement is needed, there's a very, very strong connection and a direct connection between muscle and skin. That's, for instance, at the eyebrows. With the smallest muscle contraction, we can move the skin, and this immediately and totally changes the facial expression, from looking desperate to looking angry to looking suspicious. All of this can be done with millimeters of movement of skin of the hairy eyebrow. The other area where also such a tight connection is needed is the perioral area, because the lips are needed for speaking, for food uptake, for breathing, for nonverbal communication, and that skin from the perioral area needs to be moved very, very precisely. So it means there is no distinct layer of fat between the muscles and the skin. It's not. There was even a study in 2003 which identified that there's a different subcutaneous architecture in the perioral area versus the lateral face, because in a perioral area, muscles directly connect with connective tissue fibers to the skin, versus in the lateral aspect of the face, there is a distinct layer of fat between them. And this distinct layer of fat allows for a certain degree of movement, which is not possible in the perioral area. This is why, for instance, in the perioral area, we do have the radial lines, or also sometimes referred to as smoker lines or barcode deformity. They are most frequently seen in females, but they are there because there is no layer of fat in between that kind of provides a certain degree of cushioning. The reason why females have this more frequently than males is because of hair follicles, because of beard. Because males have a beard, they stabilize the skin and prevent the skin of breaking into certain creases, and this is why males don't have that. Only females have that, which I think is a little bit unfair. But again, this is something that has to do with the underlying anatomy and with how the subcutaneous arrangement is designed by Mother Nature, which is, by the way, a female. And if we think about this, and if we extrapolate a little bit what it truly means, this subdermal, three-dimensional connective tissue architecture, it's different in the medial face and lateral face, and it's different between males and females, because, for instance, males are significantly harder to dissect than females. At least I see that on a daily basis. Males are much harder to dissect because the connections, the connective tissue fibers, are more tough and more frequent in numbers than in females, to dissect. And this is why it's always more tricky dissecting males and females. And this is why I also need more scalpel blades of dissecting the same area of male skin versus female skin, because the scalpel blade gets significantly quicker, blunter than it does in females. And the last point that I would like to mention about the difference in all of this is also the fact that this is one of the reasons why females have cellulite, because they have less connective tissue fibers per area than males do. So that means males have more support, more pillars per area, which females don't. And this is why females develop cellulite and males don't. It's kind of like the gender differences that Mother Nature, again, who is a female, kind of has designed and imprinted into our genetic code.
Now, is that just in the face or across the entire body?
That is across the entire body. Entire body, there is this gender difference between male and females in this three-dimensional connective tissue network that surrounds facial muscles.
And does that translate to thicker and tougher skin or just more adhesions?
Well, thicker and tougher skin depends on the dermis, how it is compositioned, because the dermis, the dermal thickness is different in various facial regions and differs between males and females and differs between ethnic groups. So there's a different thing. But the toughness, what you refer to, that's majorly determined by the subdermal three-dimensional connective tissue architecture, which is different between males and females. And again, the facial muscles, they are an integral part of all of this. So this is why we cannot see facial muscles isolated, like we see, for instance, in a face, the muscles of mastication, which are also located in a face, like the masseter and temporalis, but they are skeletal muscles. And they, even though they contribute to the appearance of the facial shape, like masseter muscle, very important for the lower face, for the width of the lower face, or temporalis muscle, very important for the volume of the temple. And but these muscles, they're skeletal muscles, they're totally off, and they can be seen as individual units, like just looking at temporalis, just looking at masseter. But facial muscles, you always need to see them in conjunct with the three-dimensional connective tissue architecture that surrounds them. And this makes us understand why in the past anatomists didn't do a good job, but we all hope that in the future this is getting better. It increases our understanding and it allows for better treatments and understanding why certain treatments work, why other treatments don't work so well, because anatomy and the clinical departments, they always have to work hand in hand. We learn from each other, we grow with each other, and especially for facial muscles, when it comes to understanding where to inject a neuromodulator and how to increase precision and how to understand the field of effect and why we have sometimes good outcomes, why we have sometimes adverse outcomes. All of this is necessary and has to be seen with the underlying anatomy and with the underlying pathophysiology of the facial muscles. And I cannot stress it long enough and frequently enough, the facial muscles, they need to be seen as a biomechanical unit with connective tissue. Identifying facial muscles just solely by themselves will not do the complexity justice that we have in a face. So I think that's really an important feature that I really would like the audience to take away after today's episode.
So if I can ask kind of a recapping question, not only do the facial muscles involve all of the layers above, the fat and the skin and all of the connective tissues, but unlike the skeletal muscles you were just talking about, no facial muscle actually works in isolation?
That's absolutely correct. No facial muscle works in isolation because there is no single muscle facial expression. That's the correct term. So all of facial expression that we have are all multi-muscle movements. So no facial expression depends only on one single muscle movement. Even smiling. Smiling has four muscles that contribute to the facial expression.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So on this note, I would like to thank you, Pete, for being with me here today during this session.
Thank you, as always.
And I also would like to thank the audience for being with us during this episode, which focused on facial muscles and understanding facial muscles. And with this, I would like to end today's session, and I'm looking forward to seeing you for the last episode in this season 2. And the last episode will be focusing on facial ligaments. With this, thank you very much for joining us.